Today we're going to get into a study of some of the manuscripts of the New Testament, the Greek manuscripts. I remind you that there were manuscripts of the Old Testament, what we will call the Hebrew Bible, that were written by scribes in the Hebrew language, and that were largely unintelligible to the world. Until the Septuagint was translated in about 285 B.C., so that the Hebrew Bible became a Greek product. It wasn't a perfect translation, but it was distributed throughout the world and God used it extensively. There's a verse of scripture in Isaiah. It's a repeat of a verse, it's repeated again, I guess, in Micah, that the word of the Lord shall go forth from Jerusalem. And that's what happened with the translation of the Septuagint. So the world became aware of the God of the Hebrews in a language that they could understand. And because of that, we realized where it could be that the eunuch on his way back to Africa could have a copy of the book of Isaiah to study. And so apparently it was being distributed to anyone who would purchase it. I suspect the scribes had quite a cottage industry going, preparing these books for the visitors to Jerusalem and, of course, selling them. After all, they sold sacrifice animals in the temple and were quite willing to trade for different things like that that would give them a monetary advantage. So selling God's word, it probably wasn't expensive. Unless you bought a big, expensive book like Isaiah, a long book. Isaiah's a big book. But the minister of finance from Ethiopia could well afford it, I'm sure. And so he was reading it when Philip found him. So today we're going to look at Greek manuscripts that arose in New Testament times. These are called uncials, UNCILS. The oldest ones that we had until recently were 3rd and 4th century books in Greek, copied by Greek scribes, of course. You might wonder, what's an uncial? Well, an uncial is a Greek manuscript in all capital letters. And they wrote that way. They wrote the Greek in capital letters for a long time, until about the 6th or 7th century A.D., when then they began to use upper and lower case. And if you buy a Greek interlinear New Testament, you'll find that it's that way printed, upper and lower case. Now, the upper and lower case printed letters are pretty easy to learn, but the handwritten ones are, I'll show you some examples, are a bit of a problem. Now, we're going to look at some copies of New Testament manuscripts. And we'll be doing this for the rest of the course. We got July and August to learn how to speak Greek, but how to read it. Okay, so I don't want to scare you from that because I don't read Greek either. So, but we're going to know enough about it that we can make some interesting observations about it. So that's what we want. You might say that we'll know just enough about it to be dangerous, and that's a possibility, too. But all of these manuscripts are online. I mean, we live in a marvelous time when you can see things You don't have to go to the libraries where these manuscripts are. Two of them are in the London Library, the British Library in London. And one of them is in Cairo. The Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts, CSNTM, is a very interesting website. And it's this particular study group is located in Plano, Texas. I think that's kind of interesting. You can stick this in Google and it comes out. You get to look at a long list of manuscripts that are available. Many of them are not online, but it tells you where to go to find them. And some of them, you get a guide to a different website that contains them. The Sinaiticus manuscript is available from the British Library, and it is it's a separate website. But you can find them all at this particular website, and they ask that you tell your audience where these manuscripts can be found. So we're going to look a little bit at a couple of them today. And to do that, I'll remind you, we've looked at this before, and I'll stick this up to remind you from time to time, that the Greek alphabet's pretty similar to the English alphabet, except for the ones that are in red. You see, there's a few that are different, but M, N, and O look just like they do in English. A, B, but instead of C, C is used over here in the right-hand side for the letter S. And there is no C, but there is the X, which stands for chi. And if any of you have ever taken statistics, you'll know that something about a figure known as chi-square, which is the frequency of certainty about a particular answer. But that X is really pronounced like a hard C, C-H-I, chi. And so omega, O occurs in two forms, and the one that looks like a W eventually became the lowercase omega in the Greek language, but in the Greek alphabet. But that's really an O. And the letter H has implied with it an E. And you know, that letter H is kind of strange in the English language, too, because we don't pronounce it sometimes in a word like our or honor. And so it has some trappings that were brought over from the Greek. And so it is used like an E. And so if you have the name of the king of Israel at the time when Jesus was born, his name was Herod. And we sort of put the H on there, but it has both the H and the E involved in it. So it's used like a vowel. Those are the main differences, except the one that really trips us up is what looks like a letter Y. That's a capital U. And it doesn't make any sense. I don't know why they used a Y for a U, but that's how the Greeks wrote their capital U. So you'll see why the letter Y, it sort of stands out in the manuscripts, but when you see it, think capital U. So the rest of the letters, we use a delta triangle to represent D in a number of situations in English as well, so that one's not so hard to see. The letters that are hard to distinguish are the D and the L and the A. It all depends upon this crossbar, whether you can see the crossbar in the letter A or at the bottom of the letter A, as to whether it's an A or a D. And if there's nothing there, then it's an L. So that's kind of strange to our sight. But we have some letters that are confusing to foreigners too, so we can get used to that sort of thing, and we'll point these out as we go along. But we do have to know a little bit about the Greek in order to understand some things about the manuscripts. What we're going to tell you about the forensic evidence about these manuscripts does not depend so much upon what's written there as it does how the book was put together. So you won't have to worry too much about this. But it's interesting to do, and I'll give you some examples. Now, the other thing that's strange about these manuscripts, that all the letters are run together. You'd think they could afford a little bit of space between words, but they don't. They run the letters, crowd the letters onto the line, but when you look at it in English, you can kind of read that. Those are the opening verses to the Gospel of Mark, the beginning of the Gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. It is written in Isaiah the prophet, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way, a voice of one calling in the desert, prepare the way for the Lord, make straight his paths for him. And so John came baptizing in the desert, in the desert region, and preaching a baptism of repentance for the remission, for the forgiveness of sin, and whole Judean countryside, and all the people of Jerusalem. Let that soak in. That's everybody, isn't it? They went out to him, confessing their sins, and they were baptized by him in the Jordan River. That's a very strong beginning to Mark's gospel, and we'll see that and dissect a bit of it as we go along. But your eye gets used to parsing these strings of letters into words that you're familiar with, and so I think you can read that. There's been something circulating on the internet recently that I got a copy of. I don't have it here, but said even if the words are grossly misspelled, you can still read straight through them and make a guess as to what the words are. Now, well, what happened there? There we go. Let me back up and see what that was. Well, I guess that's so faint that we can't make it out in the daylight here. Okay, there are three major manuscripts to be concerned with that are early. And how early after the time of Christ is debatable to some extent. But the two oldest ones are the Codex Sinaiticus and the Codex Vaticanus, around 325-350 A.D. Now, that's a couple hundred years after the life of the, or maybe 300 years after the life of the apostles. That's a long time. And remember, the critics' complaint about this is, it was all oral down to that point in time, and somebody sat down and figured out what the gospel should say. And we're going to make the point that those gospels were written out early, and we can show you some things about them, that these copies are late. And the interesting thing about these copies, these are copies of the whole Bible. The whole thing had been organized by this time, and in both the old, what we call the Old and the New Testament, was all in Greek. The Old Testament portion of these manuscripts is, surprise, surprise, the Septuagint, as you would have expected. That's what the church used for the Old Testament in these ages. But the New Testament part of it was pretty well completed by this time, because all of the books, the writings of Paul and John and Peter and others are all there. And they're not always in the order that they are in our Bible, but those books were known. And so beyond that, you see, Codex Alexandrinus is estimated to be 500 A.D., but these are estimated dates in which these copies were made. And obviously they were copied from another manuscript that was earlier that didn't survive. So when you get down, the one Codex Visae Canticregiensis is sometimes listed as one of the early manuscripts, and so where they say either the big three or the big four, they're talking about these. And so that's pretty far down the line from the time of Christ. But there's one that has cropped up in the 100 years ago that is more, that I will contend, and you can see the evidence, was much earlier than any of these. Now, we talked about uncials. Unseals are also, you may see the term majesticules, and that means big letters. And these are the, what's it say? Minuscule text. And so that's upper and lower case. And all of the minuscule cases that you can find copies for are much later, because they didn't write in capital and lowercase letters until later on. So those we can dispense with. But they're very pretty. Some of them are written in a very fine hand. They're decorated sometimes with some. This may be a great big E. I don't know exactly what it represents there. And I'm not sure what this text is. But just an example. Here's another one. They put elaborate headings on some of this and pictures of a tree or something. And so this happens to be the Gospel of John. And we can see John's name here, I-O. A-N-E-E-N here, which is Johannan or John. And so we take those names and sometimes anglicize them, sometimes we change them a bit, and so they look strange in the original language, but that's how John is written. And to try to read all of this is quite difficult. But in capital letters, it's not so bad. And you might know that you teach your kids to write with big A, big B, big C, D, E, F, and they learn the alphabet as capital letters usually. And they learn later on, they'll learn about lowercase letters. And finally, it gets down to this, which is a very interesting case. The writing almost seems to be script, and they're beginning to separate words, as you see here. And I have no idea what this is, because the example of this is kind of interesting. The scribe took an old manuscript and washed all the ink off of it, and then dried it. This is parchment, of course. It's animal skin, and then he wrote his new text on it in a longhand here. But the interesting thing was, when you shine it with ultraviolet light, there is another text behind it. You can see the old text that he washed away was an unseal. It was all capital letters. And so some of those texts are interesting too, but they're not as old as the big three that we talked about. Now, they estimate the age of these texts by looking at the words that are used, looking at the way the letters are made. Most of it is textual criticism as they examine it critically. But they don't generally look at the forensic evidence very much. Some of it is noted in the writings of the scholars who examined these texts. But it's interesting they didn't really take that into account in trying to figure out when it was written. This is called a palimpsest, and that happened quite a few times. It tells you that the parchment was pretty valuable. And if it was in good shape, they wanted to use it again. It got recycled. They were recyclers in a in a very real sense at an early age, weren't they? Okay. Now we're going to talk about the Codex Sinaiticus, which is one of the old ones. Sinaiticus and Vaticanus are the two oldest of the scripts, and I've given you a handout which includes some summary of the discovery and description of these different texts. The first page of many of these books is in bad shape. You can see here a lot of the letters are sort of washed out. You can, if you look at it very carefully, you can figure out what the words are. But a lot of the ink peeled off, stuck to the page that was pressed against it as the book was closed and stacked. So you have some pieces that are missing. We're going to look at Matthew 1 in a couple of weeks in some detail, and you realize that the early Codex Sinaiticus is somewhat sparse in Matthew 1. The Codex Alexandricus is missing the first two-thirds of the book of Matthew. They don't know what happened to it, but those pages are just not there. And so you want to check something in that particular one. You can't, because it's missing. That doesn't mean that it wasn't all there at one time. It just means that it got mislaid or destroyed or damaged or something. All right. And here's some more material about Sinaiticus. And it's rather interesting. We have more provenance about this one than we do the other two. What do we mean by provenance? If you watch Antiques Roadshow on TV, you know about provenance, right? Who found it? Who made it? Who wrote it? Where did it come from? Where was it created? All of these details. We don't know about Vaticanus. We don't really know all of that information about Alexandricus, but we do have quite a bit of information, not about its early life so much as the circumstances surrounding its discovery. So despite its rather austere appearance, the Codex Sinaiticus is a treasure beyond price, produced in the middle of the 4th century. Now remember, the 4th century or the 300s A.D., the Codex is one of the two earliest Christian Bibles. The other is the Vaticanus in Rome. Within its beautifully handwritten Greek text are the earliest surviving copy of the complete New Testament. Got that? The earliest surviving copy of the complete New Testament and the earliest and best copies of some of the Jewish scriptures in the form that they were adopted by the Christian church, which was what? The Septuagint. We've already talked about that. So you know the circumstances surrounding its creation. As one of the earliest luxury codices, what do we mean by a luxury book? It's large format. It's sort of like an atlas. If you have a coffee table book like that's large and beautiful and so on, that's kind of the way it appears to have been formed. It's one of the earliest to survive in large part, and the Codex forms one of the most important landmarks in the history of the Bible. Now, here's how it was found. A Greek manuscript of the Old and the New Testaments of the greatest antiquity and value was found on Mount Sinai in St. Catherine's Monastery by Constantine Tischendor. He was visiting there in 1844. And under the patronage of Frederick Augustus, King of Saxony. What do we mean by patronage? Well, that king was sponsoring his tour and his trip, wasn't he? That's all that means. He discovered in a rubbish basket 43 leaves of the Septuagint. And you know what that is. Containing portions of 1 Chronicles, Jeremiah, Nehemiah, and Esther. He was permitted to take them. And he also saw the books of Isaiah and 1st and 4th Maccabees, belonging to the same codex as the fragments, but could not obtain possession of them. So warning the monks of their value, he left for Europe and 2 years later published the leaves he had brought with him under the name of Codex Frederico Augustinus, because that's the guy that was paying the bills, okay? And after his, that's his patron. They are preserved at Leipzig. Where is Leipzig? Germany? Am I right? I think so. And so it's in a library somewhere. On a second visit in 1853, now remember this is almost 200 years ago, 175 years ago. He found only two short fragments of Genesis, which he printed on his return, could learn nothing of the rest of the codex. 1859, he made a third visit, this time under the patronage of Tsar Alexander II. This visit seemed likewise fruitless when on the eve of his departure, a chance conversation with a steward, he learned of the existence of a manuscript. Incidentally, these words that are in blue are connections to other sites that talk about these matters on the internet. When it was shown to him, he saw the very manuscript he had sought, containing beyond all his dreams a great part of the Old Testament and the entire New Testament, besides the epistles of Barnabas and part of the Shepherd of Hermas. I'm not sure what those are. We'll get Ken to explain that to us sometime. Of which two works, these two works, there were no copies in the original Greek known to exist at that time. Thinking it was a crime to sleep, Tischendorf spent the night copying Barnabas. But he had to leave in the morning, and failing to persuade the monks to let him have the manuscript, at Cairo he stopped at a monastery belonging to the same monks. They were Orthodox Greek Church, and he succeeded in having the manuscript sent to him there for transcription. And finally, in obtaining it from the monks as a present to the Tsar, Tischendorf's patron and the protector of their church, years later, in 1869, the Tsar rewarded the two monasteries with gifts of money. The manuscript is treasured in the Imperial Library of St. Petersburg. Tischendorf published an account of it in 1860 under the auspices of the Tsar, printed it in facsimile in 1862. So you see, this has been around for quite a while, at least 150 years. In age, this manuscript ranks alongside the Codex Vaticanus. And it's thought Vaticanus is slightly older. I don't know that it's just a guess. Its antiquity is shown by the writing. Here's how they try to decide these matters. By the writing, by the four columns to a page, an indication probably of the transition from the roll or the scroll to the codex form of the manuscript. That's just an aside. I don't think that's the case, but this writer did. Also, by the absence of the large initial letters, some of the manuscripts have an even larger capital letter to begin a section of the text, but that doesn't occur in these books much. And ornaments, and that's what I was telling you about, they would put a flower or a tree or something in the space between the columns and at the top. In the presence of divisions of the text antedating Eusebius, the addition of Barnabas and Hermes and so on, such indications have induced experts to place it in the 4th century, along with the Codex Vaticanus and some time before the Codex Alexandrinus. Nothing is known of its later history till its discovery by Tischendorf. So there's a gap in the provenance. We're not really sure where it went from or where it was originated. We only know where it was when Tischendorf discovered it. The text of Codex Sinaiticus bears very close resemblance to that of Codex Vaticanus, although it cannot be descended from the same immediate ancestor. What does that mean? Well, it means those two texts were not copied from a common predecessor. They came from separate copies. For separate copies, they contain some differences which indicate that they have different origins. In general, Codex Vaticanus is placed first in point of purity by contemporary scholars and Codex Sinaiticus next. This is especially true for the New Testament of the Gospels. The differences are more frequent in the Old Testament, where the Codices Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus often agree. Matt, we got stuck again. Let me back. Pardon me? Well, we only have two or three pictures. Maybe you can change it up there.
Alvin, he said the rest of them are missing. They're blank.
The rest of them are what?
Missing. They're blank. The rest of your slides are blank.
Well, that's not fair. No, they're in there. But the problem probably has to do with the fact that this is created on an Apple and then exported to Microsoft, and Microsoft is having trouble with it. All of the rest of them are blank. You want to try to reload it or something? Let me give him the primary source here. Oh, he's coming in over there. See if it'll reload. I haven't had that problem before. I don't know what the difficulty is there. All right. Now, let's improvise till he gets ready for it. I wanted to show you what I hope we can look at. There's just two or three more to look at here. Is a an introduction of the Codex Washingtonius. And we're going to look at that in detail next week. There was a treasure hunter near Cairo in Egypt who was digging holes in the sand looking for treasure, stumbled across a package that contained a book. The book appeared to be very, very ancient. He tore a couple of pages out of it to circulate among the Egyptian antiquities dealer. Let's see if he's getting anywhere here. And we'll look at those details next week. But it was ultimately bought by an American who brought it to the Smithsonian Institution and put it in his art collection there, along with some other ancient manuscripts. Any luck? Are you having any? So it was C.L. Freer is his name, the man with the money. He paid in about, it was 1906, 1908, somewhere along in there, he paid over $7,000 for this little book that contained the four Gospels. That's all it had. It doesn't contain the rest of the New Testament. It just has Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Not in that order. It's Matthew, John, Mark, and Luke is the order in which it occurs. They occur in the book together, pressed between two covers and wrapped in skins and cloth and buried in the sand. It's kind of interesting that the manuscripts that survive are all found either in Egypt or near Egypt, because the weather there is so dry, and the manuscripts are even though they're exposed in a way, they're buried in the sand. The sand is very dry, and it's hot, and they don't decay much. Did we get anything at all? Didn't get it, huh? I actually downloaded off of that drive and ran them on my computer. I know they're there, but it doesn't load into this one. I'm going to have to test everything next time. Anyway, you can see the Gospels manuscripts here, and we had a comparison of Luke 1 in the Vaticanus and Luke 1 in the Codex W. I'm going to start calling them by their initial letters. Codex V is the Vatican copy, and Codex W is the Washingtonius. Codex S would be Sinaiticus, and Codex A would be Alexandricus. I get tired of saying those long names all the time. But anyway, what you can do when you look at these manuscripts is you don't have to be able to read the manuscript in order to pick out some words that you can recognize. And I hope we'll have this problem ironed out before next time, because we're going to have to be able to see them in order to explain them. Many of the Greek words are gobbledygook, as far as we can tell. But they make perfectly good Greek language. That is just our lack of understanding. But some of the words are easily translated, because they're not translated really, they're transliterated. And so a word like baptism stands out in there because it's pretty much the same in the English as it is in the Greek. And the other set of words that we can work with to find our way through some of these passages are the names. Once you understand how the names go, and where do you like to read when you're reading a list of names in the New Testament? Well, it's the genealogies, the parts that we love to dwell on at long intervals. The genealogy in Matthew 1. Is one that we'll look at in detail because it contains the ancestry of Jesus. And so it has names like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And once you get an idea of how they're spelled in the Greek, then you can go through that because it follows a pattern of Abraham was the ancestor of, and then Isaac. And then it says Isaac, and the part that says was the ancestor of, Who's Isaac? Jacob was the ancestor of, is the same in all of the lines as you go through. So you don't have to translate that over and over again. You're just looking at the names of the individuals there. Well, we're going to finish early today because the whole system broke down. I think the devil has it in for us because, what was it, last month the bulb burned out. And this time, the machine fails somehow. There's a question over here. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. How do you do what? There, that's an interesting question. He's asking how did it come to pass that these manuscripts are in Egypt, and the Egyptians latched on to Christianity very quickly. That's the Coptic Church. The Coptic part simply means Egyptian. The Egyptian Church was very strong in the first few centuries. A lot of Christians lived in Egypt. You remember that when we're talking about the transcription of the Septuagint, that was done in Alexandria. And there were many Jews living in Alexandria. And many of them became Christians. And the other large cities in Egypt also had many Christians in them. And they built churches, church buildings, monasteries all over Egypt. And so Egypt, particularly along the Nile River, and in the area around the pyramids near Cairo, this was a hotbed of Christian activity. Now, some years toward the end of the lives of the apostles in the mid-first century, when Nero persecuted Christianity, many of the Christians fled to Egypt because it was a relatively safe place for them there. And there were many Christians living in Egypt. So that's how I think the manuscripts got there. And it may have been a place where many other manuscripts were made because of the establishment of scriptoriums. So someone could bring in a manuscript and get it copied. It's amazing that so many copies were made. You might recall that the copies that survived in the area of Jerusalem, as we talked about the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were buried in caves and protected from the weather. Well, in Egypt, there was no weather much to speak of. And if it rained, it only rained briefly and the water didn't really penetrate the sand. So things buried in the sand lasted a long time. And this particular set of manuscripts, the Codex W, was carefully wrapped and preserved. And as they dug it up, it was obvious that it was very, very ancient. So when Freer bought it, he also bought a couple of Septuagint manuscripts from the Old Testament. And that whole package cost, I was telling you, a little over $7,000, but that was an enormous amount of money in 1906. And, of course, as the document indicated, if you bought that much material today, it would be hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, to pay for it. And it's priceless. It isn't traded anywhere. And to find something new like that, I think was really God working in bringing some of these manuscripts to the United States, where we have access to them freely through the Internet. We're not going to candy coat the thing. We're going to look at some manuscripts, lay eyes upon them, and I don't understand what happened to this, but before next week I'll bring my drive up here and run everything through our computer in time. Anyway, read the handout, and it tells you pretty much the same story in brief. And we'll look at those manuscripts as we compare them. We can compare them with the gospel manuscripts from the Codex W. Thank you. I appreciate your attention and patience in this technical glitch that we ran into. We'll try to get that fixed before next time.